My name is Robert Suffey, a former member of the Black Panther Party, captured soldier of the Black Liberation Army. I can't really say when I became conscious or, took a conscientious life. Before, for the longest time, I've always felt and, really acted in the manner that I act. But I became active after 1969, having returned from Vietnam. Some of the things I was involved in, they were principle, but it wasn't the principle line that I was following. I was just following instinct. And I imagine that afterwards, I would indulge in some things that were not really considered principle. But after 1969, having returned from the war in Vietnam and being very disillusioned by a lot of things and understanding the fight of the Vietnam struggle and the heroic people of Vietnam, I began to take a greater interest in the lifestyles of poor people in America. At that time, we had the Black Panther Party on the one hand, the Young Lords Party and the Hispanic community, and the Weather Underground. Most of these organizations were somewhat active on the college campuses that I was visiting at the time. And that's what really drew my attention to, recognition that a lot of people's approaches and opinions in life were similar to my own. However, they had taken it to a greater degree through arduous struggle and, considerable, investigation and analyzation that I had failed up to that point to do, and wanting to know and to be properly prepared for the struggle that I believed in, I became active. So roughly around 1969, I became active in the Black Panther Party and continued in that activity until roughly 1971-72. Thereafter, through the onslaught of COINTELPRO and other activities by the New York City's police department, oppressive tactics and such, I was forced underground to continue on the activities of really performing humanitarian activities and duties. Through the course of that activities, it was naturally a consequence that as the state was actively pursuing and oppressing us and attacking us, that eventually they too were attacked. In the course of this continued backwards and forwardness and this, the deaths on both sides of the coin, the state decided that it would no longer need or have to follow any legality. Any approach that it chose to use would be appropriate. They would just have to, make the end justify the mean. And to that extent, oftentimes, comrades found themselves names submitted into indictments that were carrying, say, 12 John Does and 6 Jane Does. They just knew that an activity had occurred. They didn't know who was involved or, any descriptiveness about the person. But once people were captured, their names were instituted into these indictments, and what with the oppressiveness of the grand jury, grabbing people and saying, well, you faced the contempt of court criminal charges as such if you did not, give us information about people that we are actively pursuing. It was just a matter of time before they were able to convince the public that they had actually captured and broke the back of a major liberation struggle. However, like most struggles worldwide, this one too was phoenix-like, to coin their phrase. They claimed to have destroyed it, and it saw a rebirth. My activities were cut short, say from 69 to 73, when I was captured and convicted of several attempted murders and murders of police officers. I was rudely taken to prison, to court, and, you know, and just my rights violated and just shanghaied and given a conviction. To the extent that once they were able to conduct a conviction and establish that they had one of the members, it was easy to bring up other cases that were unsolved and just give them to everybody. So I wound up with comrades, you know, as co-defendants that I'd never known, never met before, you know, and basically just received a whole lot of time. As a result of the convictions that I received, I have approximately 11 life bids. Now, because of the time and the nature of oppression at that particular time, I was given the maximum sentence at that time, a given time, of 1973, which totaled 25 to life. At the time, because I was convicted of a capital 1A crime, every other crime thereafter had to run concurrent with it. Today, they have a different approach. They can now address a case concurrently. Had I got busted today for the crimes that were committed, I was charged with then, I would be doing something like 245 years to life very easily. Or in this case, life without parole, or 75 years plus life, you know, whatever.
How old were you when you first went, when you were captured and when you went to jail?
I was exactly 24 years old when I first came to prison. Due to my activities, I was well known in the community. Yeah, I had worked numerous hours and in numerous locations as a member of the Black Panther Party, from, you know, our free medical coalition to, you know, our legal assistance and, you know, just breakfast programs and so on and so forth. So I was known. When it came time for information and I was no longer available, I became targeted as one of the initiators of criminal activities, and it was up to me to convincingly display that I had nothing to do with that. The only way that that could be resolved satisfactorily was for me to give somebody else up in my place, and that would have justified that I had nothing to do with it. Short of that, you know, I would be convicted like everybody else. So, at the age of 24, I came into the system, and shortly thereafter, I had a birthday. And I began my first year at the age of 25 in the penitentiary.
You've now served over 30 years in jail in the United States, and I'm wondering how you've managed to keep yourself together to maintain a positive outlook on life and to keep your spirits up in the context of these dehumanizing conditions.
Well, I equate most of that to the principles of liberation and struggle. I'm talking universal principles, you know, that are applicable in many, many arenas and many struggles. That, coupled with the fact that there are so many beautiful people out there in the streets, you know, and some that were captured for short periods of time and some that were never captured, new supporters. I mean, a constant influx of new energy, new ideas working for humanitarian cause. All these things, coupled with principles, have kept my sanity, kept me focused and aware of my environment, you know, my impact on my environment as well as my environment's impact on me. It's allowed me to not sway from my determination to continue contributing towards humanity in any shape, form, or fashion that I'm able to do so. I mentor, I teach, I instruct, you know, I show through example, and it's just a broad range of ideas and circumstances that, you know, that I'm able to address.
You came up on parole in 1998, mm-hmm. and that was the first date that you had available for parole, and you've been turned down since then on several occasions, and I'm wondering if you could spend a couple minutes talking about your fight for parole and why you think that you've been denied parole.
Well, when I was convicted, and as a consequence of all of my convictions, I've had maybe four cases, my sentencing after all of that was 25 years to life. According to New York State's law, criminal law, the punishment phase of my sentence was to be 25 years. Given that there was no adjustment or repentiveness or maturity in that time frame, the life at the end of it would constitute justification based on mitigating circumstances to continue to hold until at such time as these states of maturity were manifest. In 1998, when I first appeared before the parole board, I appeared before the parole board as an educated person, a strong disciplinary history, strong work ethic, and had participated and was awarded many certificates and in degrees of educational processes. When I appeared before the parole board stated in its denial of parole at that time was that the serious nature of my crime concluded that I should not receive parole at that time. Of course, I appealed because one of the tactics that the state used at that time was to apply my military record. In 68-69, I had did a tour in Vietnam. I had also did some time in the stockade. Military discipline and civilian life disciplines are two different levels. Articles that are considered as laws in civilian life, but they don't carry the same significant consequences unless you have really done something really, really negative. As it was in my case, I did small bids in the stockade, no more than a month or two at the longest, and only once or twice, and then, for minor, infractions. But the state, in my parole hearing, used that information illegally and applied it and said that I had a criminal history. According to New York State law, they cannot use military. The military history cannot cross over into civilian life unless I sign a waiver and acknowledge that you have my permission to do so. I never did it. To this day, I've never done it. But they say that, well, they can use it, and it's been a moot point as far as the courts are concerned. In the year 2000, I went to my second board. Again, I was hit with 2 years based on the serious nature of the crime. I began to reflect on the serious nature of the crime, trying to understand what exactly was the law, governing that particular aspect. And what I discovered was, again, the minimum part of the sentence, and in my case, my minimum is 25 years. The minimum portion of my sentence satisfies the seriousness of my crime. Because I had no assault on staff, no assault on inmates, or had any real violations of any prison rules or regulations, the serious nature of my crime had already been satisfied 25 plus 2 years ago. So, upon pending in my appeal, I was of the opinion that, based on all of the arenas of the law and past law, this should have, initiated reconsideration of this arbitrary and capricious attack by the commissioners of the parole system. The courts again turned down my appeal, and 2 years were carried. In the year 2002, I appeared before the parole board, and the third time I was given a 2-year sentence for the serious nature of my crime, and again a visit to my military history, saying that because I had spent some time in the stockades in 68 and 69, it showed a criminal pattern, which how they come to that conclusion, I do not know. In 2004, I will again appear to the parole board for the fourth time. Now, each time I've appeared for the parole board, you know, I've been able to demonstrate that in reality, nothing has changed in the 2 years that I've appeared before you. I still carry a strong and creditable disciplinary history, a strong and effective work ethic, given the fact that I was a young man back then in 1973 when I was captured and convicted. That particular young man does not exist anymore. There are no mitigating circumstances to point back to that time. All you have is a record for the past 31 years that reflects who I am here and now. In accordance with the law, I am to be released in accordance with the law. In accordance to one's personal opinions and, you know, the illegal attributes of the now governor of New York State who advocates that violent felons should not receive parole, which is in violation of New York State law and New York State Constitution, by virtue of his statements, his commissioners are illegally following his personal attack and endeavor, as opposed to following the dictates of the law and the guidelines for which they have been appointed to represent. In 2004, I will appear again before the parole board, and again I will establish the pattern that has been existing for the past 31 years. I have completed the 25 years. I have completed the serious nature of the crime. I have not received any, you know, charges or major infractions within this facility in the past 31 years that would, could be used as mitigating circumstances to say, well, as a matter of fact, nothing has changed. You know, this particular person, when he was convicted in 1973, has been committing all these criminal acts up until today, and so we see no change.
Seth, I want to move on to another question because we're starting to run short on time. And there's been, for a number of years, a very serious medical condition that's developed with you in regards to hepatitis C and diabetes.
Yes.
And we've sort of got more information on that elsewhere and in previous interviews that we've done with you, but I'm wondering if you could draw the connections between the serious medical complications that are arising when political prisoners of your generation that have been incarcerated in the prison system of the U.S. for the last 25 or 30 years, and specifically talk about your comrades Teddy Jah Heath and Albert Noah Washington, and any kind of similarities or sort of patterns that you see as existing in that in those cases.
Well, the similarities are glaring.
Maybe if you could explain a little bit about who these two individuals were as well.
Okay. First is Albert Noah Washington, known to most of us as Noah. Noah was a key figure and member of the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party. He was very affluent, a historian in the party, and well-liked and well-known. Noah Washington was one of the New York Three, who was captured and convicted of murder of two police officers in New York State City in the year 1971. Over the years, and you know, the many institutions Noah was housed in, Noah finally arrived in Clinton Correctional Facility around 1991. At that time, Noah began to demonstrate, you know, severe pains in his back, you know, an inability to sit for long periods of time or, you know, to be able to move very well. Nor was very active in the Islamic community inside the facility, as well as very active in the community overall in helping to resolve and to bring forth a more principled line within the facility and amongst prisoners to prisoners. For the longest time, under the care of Clinton Correctional Facility, Nor was told that his pain that he was suffering were side effects of his diabetes. And this carried on from the early 90s into the year 2000. In the year 2000, Nor, after being incapacitated to the point where he could almost not move, was moved secretly from Clinton Correctional Facility to Comstock Correctional Facility, where it was disclosed and diagnosed that Nor had cancer, and had cancer for a number of years, but for some reason or another was never diagnosed as having cancer. When information came to us that Nor was suffering from this and he had been complaining for so long, I became suspicious. Like, how would it be possible to have all these lab reports and these blood, tubes of blood taken from him on a continuous basis and not discover that this is what was, going on with him? So I accepted the fact that Nor was given a death sentence. Once it was discovered that he had a serious condition, that condition was allowed to deteriorate to the point that it became irreversible, and then he was notified. I was in Comstock at the time, and I was almost able to see Nor, but Nor got too sick and could not make the connection at the visiting room for us to see each other, because we had not seen each other for a number of years. Nor was sent to another facility, to like a hospice, where Nor died.
Could you speak a bit about Teddy Jahis?
Teddy Jahis was another historian and a very astute, politically analytical mind in the Black Panther Party as well as the BLA. Teddy and I had spent the last 12 years, an early part of my beard, 12 years together before we were finally separated, and we communicated, over the years. Around 2001, after the death of Nor, I received a message from Jah that he was in Greenhaven Correctional Facility, and after being absent for a number of years, and that he was, he just really disliked the place. He had been transferred there, and he disliked it, and he was going to transfer out of there within 90 days. He was going to do the 90 days requirement and then seek a transfer out of there. Jah had been complaining of stomach pains and had been complaining of stomach cramps and constipation for 2 years. But Jah was diagnosed as having, not an ulcer, but complications close to an ulcer that was developing, and he was just getting up in age. After that message from Jah, within 30 days, Jah was dead. It was then revealed that Jah had cancer of the stomach and had had cancer for a number of years. Again, it was never diagnosed or explained that Jah was suffering from this cancer. Again, the pattern was established that we were allowed to have these, debilitating diseases, and were not informed to the extent that we could receive any type of treatment for our conditions, and were allowed to deteriorate to the point by the time we were told we were in a state of deterioration. I myself have hepatitis C, and when I developed diabetes, that type 2 diabetes in the year 2000, it was then revealed to me that I had hepatitis C. So curiously, I wanted to discover, where could this have come from? I was first told, first of all, I have to accept the fact that, hepatitis C can, remain dormant in the body for up to 20 to 25 years. So I could have easily have gotten it while I was in the street, either through dirty needles or sexual contact, the same way you would catch AIDS, or through tattoos and so on and so forth, blood transfusion. At the point point I left off when they were discussing my hepatitis C, and I was inquiring, and they told me about this length of time where they would lay dormant in my system. And at that time, they told me I was at a stage where it was like newly forming within my system, so that deducting 25 years, I'd already been down 4 years already. So it would be almost impossible to determine or to state emphatically that I received this from out there in the street. So it had to come from within. So we began to analyze and talk about what the possibilities of where it might have come from. I told him I had no transfusions, I had no tattoos, I had engaged in no sexual contact, in the facility. So I was at a loss to discover where it had come from. Then I began to reason and rationalize that, like most people coming into the system, I was young, I was very fertile and strong, I've always been in good shape. And so I never really visited, hospitals and sick calls and stuff like that, unless it was mandatory call-outs. Every 2 years, it was mandatory to come and give blood, that your blood be tested to determine how you were doing inside the facility. It is my belief that somewhere in that time frame, in one of those injections of taking my blood, I was hit with a dirty needle, and I was hit with a needle that had this particular infection. And it had to have been within, in the 2000 range, within the last 15 years, because as they explained to me, this hepatitis C was just becoming effective. If it had laid dormant 15, 20 years, it would still be only at that stage, long after I had been in penitentiary. So when I began to make noise and to try to discover where all the stuff was coming from and what it was going to, they began to quickly shut down, and I got no more information about my hepatitis C. From 2000 to 2001, there was nothing actively done about my hep C. I had to fight, I had to push to get a liver biopsy. As a consequence of being in Comstock Great Meadows Correctional Facility and pressing for a liver biopsy to determine where exactly was, the level of the hepatitis C, whether I had cirrhosis of the liver or whatever, I was moved from Comstock and transferred in a medical transfer to Clinton Correctional Facility to receive a liver biopsy. When I got here, I discovered how antiquated this medical system here was, far more so than it was in Comstock. In Comstock, I was allowed, to do daily finger sticks, at least twice a day, before each meal, before each injection of insulin, to determine where my blood sugars was, and to reassure myself that I had it under control, that I was still continually eating the right amount of foods, I wasn't exercising over my limit, and I wasn't really, falling off of my prescribed routine. When I got to Clinton, I was quickly informed that they do not do any finger sticks here, that there's no need to do any finger sticks here, that they take our blood once every 3 months, and that tells them more about what's going on than the finger sticks are. So I agree that it pops apps that, taking of the blood, you that, but it doesn't tell me anything. And because we're a partnership in my health care, I need to know how I'm doing on this control mechanism. And because you have nothing in place that I can come to and be informed of how I'm doing, in terms of interview with my healthcare practitioner, to be informed about how I'm doing or this, that, and the other, or what I need to do or not do, because none of that is in place, it's like hit or miss here. Since I've been here in Clinton, I received a liver biopsy. At some point in time, I was given medication for Hep C to control my hepatitis C. When I inquired from other people who were taking similar injections for hepatitis C, and I was hearing about all these nasty side effects that people were undergoing, very afraid because I didn't know what was going to happen, because I was at a weakened state. But I soon discovered I was having no side effects. So after about a month, you know, I began to inquire more intensively. And I mean, people were actually losing weight, had poor muscle function, disoriented, flu-like symptoms, you know, just weakened and in pain. I was feeling none of these things. However, I noticed that the back of my arm, where the injection site was, it was drying out. It became very, very dry, to the point that it was becoming discolored. When I inquired about that, nobody would answer my questions, and nobody could tell me why I wasn't having any side effects. This went on for almost 8 months, and they abruptly told me, well, listen, this stuff is not working, it's not doing any good, we're not doing any better, so we're just going to stop this treatment here. That was stopped in, I think, 2001 or 2002, and since that time, nothing has been done for my hepatitis C. No treatment, no injection, no nothing. I thought about it for a long time, and I concluded that I was never really treated for hepatitis C. What I received was a placebo. I never got so much as a sniffle in terms of a side effect. And it did absolutely, totally nothing. I watched people who were taking medication, and I saw the changes. I saw the skin pallor. I saw everything that was going on with them, and none of that was happening with me. So I concluded after a time that there was just nothing. And we put pressure on them from the street about this hepatitis C. They gave me a telecom interview with a doctor from another facility through closed circuit TV. And they told me that, in essence, there was some new material about hepatitis C in the works, and as it evolves, I would be put in tune with that. And I think that was like in 2003. It's been several years now. I've received no treatment. I don't think I'm going to be receiving any treatment. And I'm just sitting here, just going through the changes.
Could you elaborate for a couple minutes about your current campaign in which you're asking to be transferred from Clinton Correctional Facility to a different facility?
Okay. That is a concurrence of my diabetes. I've always been very conscious about, you know, maintaining stability and control with my diabetes, albeit without being able to check. I still watch what I eat. I eat timely, I exercise, and I take my medication. Sometime in October, something happened to me. I was given an injection in the early morning, which I normally do. I get injections at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I get the next injection between 3 and 4 in the evening. The injection I get in the morning at 6 o'clock is supposed to cover me all the way through to the course of the day. Approximately 10 o'clock that morning, I became disoriented. I knew early on that I was hungry, and I was trying to wait for the 11 o'clock, you know, mess or run. It was approximately 10 o'clock I began to notice I was getting hungry, and I was hoping that, you know, because my sugars were starting to drop, that I could hang out to 11 to get to the mess hall to eat, because I was at work. I had these things before, and I've always been able to, you know, go ahead and eat and, you know, straighten myself out. But by 10:30, quarter to 11, I became so disoriented that I abruptly left my job and went back to the block. Now, when they called the go back for those who come up to the school's areas for interviews, they leave about a quarter to 11 or 11 o'clock. And around 11:15, 11:20, we leave and we go right to the dining hall and then come back to work. But when they called this, I was so disoriented, I got up and I left with her. Somehow, I made it back to the block and was confused because I thought we were going right to the mess hall. When somebody informed me, no, we have to go to the block. And then from the block, we'll let out ourselves to go to the mess hall. So I knew subconsciously on a low level that I had did something wrong and I was in the wrong place. But I went along with it. I went upstairs. When I got to my cell, I was extremely tired, and I laid down and I went to sleep. My sugars was already dropping. I was already in a close comatose state, but I was really dropping fast. And I went to sleep. Fortunately, some friends of mine from Maine had decided on a surprise visit that day, and they had come for me. And in coming for me, you know, the brothers was banging on the wall for approximately 15 to 20 minutes to tell me that my door had been open for almost 20 minutes and I had gotten called for a visit. Still in a delirious and disoriented state, I came downstairs to get a pass to go to the visiting room. Because I was in what they call a drunken stupor from low sugar, prison guard saw me, assumed that I was strung out on some kind of drugs and some kind of something that was so high that they wrestled me to the floor, put me in handcuffs, and determined as a last resort to take me to the hospital to determine what I had taken. When they got me up in the hospital, the nurse recognized that I was diabetic, immediately moved to try to resolve it and basically tried to bring me around. They gave me injections of intravenous sugars until I began to come around. As I was adjusting and coming around, I overheard the argument between the sergeant and the nurse about my drug activities. And she was explaining that, no, he is a diabetic, and that's insulin shot. And this is what this is, and that's how that is. I came out of it. Eventually, they talked to me. They just told me, well, listen here, take this sandwich, drink this juice. Okay, you're much better. Okay, you can go back now. So my first thought was that, well, they had given me the wrong insulin that morning because this had a reaction within 4 hours, and that was like a dangerous state. I went to the visit, finished the visit off, and then I went back to my cell. Within a week's time, I dropped out again. Same thing, I woke up, I was in the hospital. And then I began to notice it was a pattern. The pattern was nobody discussed what had happened to me, what the possibilities of me preventing it, or what it might have triggered it, or anything. It was just revive him and send him back to the cell. Excuse me. After that October 19th episode, I suffered 10 more of those episodes until February 10th, when I was writing a letter, you know, to put out into the streets and communicating that I was receiving no medical treatment here. I had had numerous attacks, you know, of insulin attacks, and I didn't know why I was going out. I was unconscious. I would come to, and I would be in the hospital. They would revive me, and they would send me back. Just sending back to a cell. No one has talked to me. No one has seen it necessary to call me up for an interview. There's no access to finger sticks so I can monitor this. And the new aspect of it was coming so fast that 1 minute I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I'm getting hungry. I need to eat. And the next minute I would wake up and I'd be in the hospital without any memory of how I got there, what occurred while I was en route there or anything. When I asked for help the day that I was writing the letter out on the 10th, I passed out again. I was typing 1 minute, and then I woke up and I was in the hospital, and I had 2 injections into my vein. And enough was enough. I began to ask for help from the street. My intentions was to tell everyone that, contrary to popular belief, no one talked to me. No one saw fit to say, well, we should give you some kind of finger sticks, or we should put you in the hospital and monitor you for, you know, over several days and during that course, take your blood sugars 3 or 4 times during the course of the day to determine when your sugars are starting to drop so that we can either adjust your insulin or, you know, increase your exercise habits to do something. No one talked to me at all. As a consequence, once the word went out in the street and it began to filter back in here, within a week's time, adjustments appeared. One of the first adjustments that appeared was the release of keto diastrips. keto diet strips are just strips that you urinate on that are supposed to monitor your blood sugar. They cost all of $10 for a box of 50. They could have given me this a long time ago. Common sense, you know, it begs the question, well, if he's falling out three or four times, wouldn't it have been a good idea to do something, you know, to try to discover what it is that's causing it and when it is, so that he would have some kind of means to control it? And short of that, having gone through all of those changes, why not, you know, investigate it and give him a proper physical examination and give him some kind of explanation about what was causing or where it was coming from? None of that occurred until community-sponsored people began to speak out directly and demand a transfer to a facility that has in place a medical program that will answer his needs as a diabetic and as well as a hepatitis C. I am afraid that given these blackouts that I've been going through, you know, not knowing what it's doing, how much oxygen, lack of oxygen to the brain that I'm having, and what side effect it's causing, having no treatment, having no examination, having no dialogue with anybody, and these things are constantly occurring, I am afraid that by the time anybody becomes aware that I'm going through a lot of changes, that'll be at my funeral. And they'll be wondering, well, how come we didn't know? And we'll be left with the explanation from Department of Correctional Services to explain what it was that occurred and deny forever that it had any collusion with my death. By me getting out there up front and saying that, listen, I fear for my life, and I truly do, and this is the reason that I base that suspicion on, it has put the Department of Correction in a precarious position to now respond. They have responded so far by giving me urinary strips without any explanation of how they work, how I should use them, or anything else. I was just given the package and to read the insert and then try to figure out what's going on my own. All attempts to see anybody has failed. Until recently, again, due to outside support and pressure, I was given an interview with one of the doctors who concluded that, well, it seems that I'm taking, 70-30 insulin and injections twice a day, but I'm also receiving metformin in a pill form twice a day at 850 milligrams, say 1,700 milligrams per day. That's too much insulin. This is their explanation now about why I've been falling out going on 4 months. So I was abruptly cut off of the metformin. I don't know what kind of, you know, reaction it's going to have after taking it for more than 3 years. One of the curious things that was spoken about at the time when this meds was canceled was that the doctor told me that it's crazy that I'm taking all of this medication, and who would be so stupid as to give this stuff to me? I explained that the doctor that I was talking to, Dr. Kang Lee, was the one who prescribed this medicine for me, and since 2001, and every 30 days, it is he who renews it. So for all these 3 years, that all this crazy medication I've been taking, Dr. Lee has been signing and approving. But now he has discovered that it was crazy, and I don't know if what he's saying is true or not, but I do know I'm so petrified that I don't wait for hunger to come. The slightest little indication that there might be an attack in the wings somewhere waiting, and I begin to eat. I've discovered now that if I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I can't determine why I woke up or what's woken me up, I'll have to sit out and eat. Start to eat again. The danger of that is when your sugars are high and you're eating and you're driving them up even higher, and there's no way of questioning or knowing, or there's no way of postulating if the circumstance they have me here going through. Without finger sticks, I don't know anything. The urine strips that they give me, I don't know if they work or they don't. They always register negative. But I feel uncomfortable in some days, and some days I feel good. But it always says the same thing. And I haven't a clue about, you know, how to use it properly. This is guesswork. This is why I think it is imperative to get out of here. If I'm left here, I truly believe it will be my demise. And it will be based on, well, who knows? Who can say? We're the medical department. We say this. We say he's been given proper medical treatment. But in reality, they're just biding their time. I have determined that I will survive. And I've determined that in short of survival, I will live a good life until it's gone. So I will continue to do the work that I've, you know, committed myself to do in terms of, you know, working on, you know, the parole commissioners' arbitrary and capricious attacks on prisoners as they come up dutifully for parole. I'm working with the Lifers organization to do as much as I can. I'm also mentoring, working, exercising, eating, and working with community and family as much and as strongly as I can. If I'm not removed from this environment to a location where there is in place a monitoring system, where patients are involved in the medical treatment on a daily basis, if I remain here, I have no doubt that, like Norm and like Josh, it will be my hasty demise, which I believe is the strategy and tactic that they have for political prisoners who have somehow abided through longevity, have not come out of here insane or strung out on drugs and mental medication, are not attacked by prison population because of the opportunity to score points or to be a big man. We just seem to righteously live here and abide here and grow here. And so they've hit upon a new solution that, well, we'll have to just do it in a way that we don't really look like we've done anything. If we, anywhere you would catch them to have an incurable disease, and we don't monitor it and we don't take care of it, and that disease kills them, then who can say we've done anything? But that's just my opinion. And I think it is shared by a lot of people, based not so much as my word, but the reality of what isn't occurring while we're sick in here, and how in the past and in the recent present, how the attention to our plights are ignored and treatment is withheld until it comes too late.
We just got a few more minutes here, and I'm wondering if we could move on to talking about the anti-war movement, if you've got
it. Oh, excellent. Yes.
What I wanted to ask you is that today on March 20th is the one-year anniversary of the war that the United States launched in Iraq, and I'm wondering if you've got what kind of a message you might have to people on the outside who are organizing against this war, and any observations that you might have as to the conduct of this war.
Obviously, those who are actively in conscious of this war are aware of the mitigating circumstances involved in this war, what this war was concerned with, and what it was designed to accomplish. And that was, it was a land grab. It was an opportunity to reshape the entire Middle East Islamic concepts to one more palatable to capitalism's approach to what they feel Islam should be. They want to forestall any future resistance to this takeover by placing Islam in a terrorist category, so to speak, so that realistically, if you wanted to adhere to your Islamic tradition and culture, you would have to do so in a way that is compatible with what capitalism thinks it should be, or be considered or designated as a terrorist. Those of us who struggle realize that the consequences of such acts and action breeds resistance, and resistance to a greater and greater degree. It cannot be expected that people just roll over and accept the fact that their lives are now been shortened and determined, predetermined for them, not only for themselves, but for generations thereafter. And that the resistance that is unfolding based on historical developments and histories of other countries is now increasing. For the most part, Americans who, unlike their government, do not travel, you know, and have limited information, are unaware of how much, you know, discreditness they have as Americans worldwide. They're unaware of this patriotism claiming that defends human rights are really oppressive actions and states of capitalist greed that are being unfolded. What we have here and what we have to tell to resistors is we have a right to live. We have a right to self-determination, but we must think in terms of collectiveness. There are many, many ethnic groups, religions, cultures out there that we are going to have to live side by side for in the world. We cannot allow ruthless, avaricious, greedy, you know, businessmen and congressional people to make these kind of decisions that impact on our lives without us really becoming conscious first and foremost and then resisting or building a society in a resistance against that. America is now recognizing this on its allied front with many disclosing like it is unacceptable the loss of life. It is unacceptable because it is class division in terms of the loss of life. Spain recently experienced a devastating, you know, blow to its activities, even though its population did not support this war. The people of Pakistan, who's ruthless general dictator who has seized power and took off his uniform and now wears a certain tie, is perpetrating a just war, is going to realize that the people who did not support it are going to resist. America, if it does not recognize its responsibilities in society and the law, will suffer the consequences of the backlash of resistance worldwide. You know, America's name will be equated with Nazism, even though it's not applicable in terms of contributive aspects, but because it kept quiet and silent, and it did not resist when repression in the form of its government was moving forward.
We should probably leave it there, Seth, because I think we've got about another 30 seconds or so, or a minute at the most.
Mm-hmm. I concur. So I just roll sometimes.
No, it's very good, very good. It's going to make great listening.